welcome the members in this new year of Action 2017. And we thank you for giving us this opportunity to make presentation on two or three matters which should sometimes look very technical, but they are very significant. And the first group of presentation, they be talking, focusing on areas of our international work within the broader task of promoting rule-based multilateral system of global governance. That's a context to these two conventions ratification for the second one, which should be done later, is that one of deepening our transformation in order to ensure that participation of those who were deliberately excluded in the economic participation by the system of colonialism and apartheid, which were blacks in general and Africans in particular. So if I start with the first set, this year we'll be celebrating the 100th birthday of our national hero, O.R. Tambo, who was a real internationalist. I think we really will be celebrating his exemplary leadership and foresight in fighting to defeat the apartheid regime and advance the fairer, equitable form of global governance. And, of course, the international solidarity which he mobilized for the development of the citizens of the world as a whole. And in this year of celebration, I thought I should just quote one thing before we start. There was a letter he wrote in 1974. I think it's quite telling so that we have the context of what was happening in our past, because sometimes we forget, because all of us are now Democrats, and which is good for a young democracy. He wrote to the secretary of the then OAU, Jefferson. He said, South Africa's racist, the South African racists and their imperialist allies have prepared very carefully, sparing neither money nor effort to ensure that they transform South Africa into a strong fortress for the defense of huge imperialist economic stakes in our country and a springboard for the subversion of the African Revolution and recolonization of Africa. He went on to say the ANC, in its whole leadership and membership at home and abroad, working with the people, are bending every effort for the realization of this fascist task. While we are convinced that we shall win our struggle by our own efforts, we are also convinced that without massive assistance from OAU and the people of independent Africa, our struggle will take much longer and costly to our people. We therefore appeal for assistance and solidarity. It is vital that now we should intensify pressure for the total isolation of apartheid South Africa, paying particular attention to the imperialist countries such as the United States, France, West Germany, Japan, and Israel, who defy resolution of the OAU and the United Nations that declare that apartheid is a crime against humanity. So I thought I should just bring this context as we deal with these amendments, because it is part of that broadening solidarity across nations in a rule-based multilateral system. The first presentation will focus on the 2010 ITU conference, which took place in Mexico. The key importance of this is that it really started to introduce the debate around cybersecurity. It introduced the internet agenda for real discussions in the ITU. And some of the resolutions, which were quite progressive, is that one of free online access to ITU by member states, because we're paying quite a huge sum of money just to access the research information which is under the hands of the ITU. And more importantly, among the resolution was that one of a shared online protection, which is quite critical in protecting our young people from the exploitation over the web. It also resolved for the first time that we must really review these regulations, which were very old regulations governing the international telecommunications, and which led eventually, although this was taken, resolution taken in 2010, as we know, to the 2012 ITU regulations, which we adopted in December last year together with the 2015 WRC Final Act. Thanks to the committee for processing those first two as a priority. So we're in the journey to try and finalize all the relevant international instruments which were signed before. If we ratify, then we can take some of the positive elements of them and make them applicable in our domestic situation or law. If we take, for instance, the second one, which the officials would deliberate on this, is the ATU 99 Convention of the ATU, African Telecoms Union. We seem to be going back. Last year we adopted 2015, went to 2012, now 2010, and now we're in 2009. We have thought about this, because sometimes we find these things and they somehow get, because of challenges, not ratified. And that's why we although we tabled them at the same time last year, because of the schedule of Parliament, we couldn't process all these things at the same time. Regarding the ATU Convention, why are we bringing this thing? That would be the question. If it was submitted, if it was signed in 1999. As you know, in 2002 in Durban, we established the AU, which was a new form of AU. And the AU came with its own constitutive act. The challenge we have been facing that the AU, because of the challenges with its multiple agencies, which was really draining money because they were just sometimes not fully under the full control of the AU. They were just doing their own things, but when they're in debt, they'll pass it to the AU. The AU Constitutive Act then abolished the agencies and established what is called specialized technical committees. Now, what we've been debating then, it didn't speak about agencies. It's only recently now that the Specialized Committee on ICT have had a formal relationship with the ATU through a formal MOU that we are able now to take this forward. In addition, ourselves and our lead department, DECO, we have also looked at this and agreed that through the legal advice that the actual signing was done in 1999. So we should, for those two reasons, ratify the convention. But lastly, Chairperson, it is important that what is the strategic importance of the ATU when we have got the specialized committee of the AOAU, of the African Union. ATU is a regional body of the International Telecommunications Union. As you know, as Africa, we've been really struggling to get common positions for us to put for the African agenda. As we said previously, in terms of the ITU, we are belonging to a region called Region 1. That Region 1 is both Europe and Africa. Europe is far ahead of us in all forms of development. So when the regulations are made, sometimes they are made to be in favor of Europe, and we suffer as the African continent. So it gives us a platform while we belong to Region 1 to be able to push for common positions as an African group. But by the time we go there, our voice can be heard. So those are the few reasons why we are thinking that it is important to continue to support this relationship between the African Union and the ACTU. And the last one, just as a form of introduction, I know it comes later, is the B-Sector Council, which is led by the Chairperson and the Deputy Chairperson, who would be introduced. We are very grateful that Chairperson has prioritized this presentation, so that the members can have a full grasp of what are they grappling with. This council, we took quite a long time, but we pushed for finalization of its formation through the branch. And as you know, we have to consult the industry. It's not just a board which is just made by us. The nominations are done by the industry, and it's not just the ICT sector. It also includes the whole IT and the broadcasting environment. So the industry has made nominations. The bulk of the members are really people who are coming as representative of different sectors of the industry. But they will give you, there will be those who are coming from representing the workers, the community sector, and as government, who are only represented by two. And we made our own nomination, and the other Department of Communication is also making its own nomination. I'd like to stress that, however, while we had our own choice to make our own representative, because of the balances which we have to create, it was difficult to get a person with disability when these nominations were being made. So as a department, our own person is also representing the disability sector in this environment. Chairperson, the main aim of this thing, in my simple understanding, is to broaden the participation, as we have been talking in our introduction, that not everyone was made to participate. Blacks in general, all marginalized groups, women, whether black and white, they were not allowed to fully participate in the economy. Our youth are very key, particularly in this sector, for the participation, and the people with disability, that they should form an integral part of this revolution of the ICT. So that's a main aim of broadening the participation, not just as consumers or trickle down, but active participants in the real economy in the ICT sector. really, what we have created now is this partnership between government, community sector, and government to have some, through this partnership agreement, measurable results and actually come up with measurable progress of how we're actually transforming this sector. I'd like to congratulate Ms. Erinze and the team for their really steady work. When we first appointed the council, they worked very quickly to consult the industry. I think we are one of the first sectors who have really finalized the sector-specific code out of the generic code, which is very critical. Because that's what will bring certainty. What do we mean by this broad-based economic transformation in this sector? I'd like just to, in conclusion, to say we have notified all our entities, particularly companies, because it's also applicable, these new codes are applicable to state-owned entities. As departments, as state-owned companies, will also be judged whether are we promoting this FTP through this broad-based economic empowerment. So Centec is here, so you'll be measured and you must comply. And it's going to be important that the, as government, those particularly where there's government interest, we lead as example. We cannot expect the industry to comply if we ourselves are not complying. So that's the work we're doing, and I'm sure when they present, they can present the details of the scope of their work, who they are, and what they are doing. They are really not very, very well resourced, and we'll be trying to look at how best do we resource because of the critical importance of their work. It's not just a technical concern. But if it's not resourced to function adequately, from our side, we'll commit that we'll try our level best to fund it, but I think the industry, Centec, also must find way of empowering the council to do this work, because they have to do research, they have to do studies, they have to run there, they have to educate the companies what these things mean, because companies have to comply. They have to make sure that there's no fronting, because fronting in the past was very rare. they have to make sure that I was hoping that you can expand just, although we've got time constraints, to say, what does this B code really mean? Because there's a fundamental shift from just management and the ownership shares and just appointing few to real empowerment. What do you do as a company in terms of your procurement? What do you do as a company in terms of enterprise development and all those things which means real participation in the economic activity other than just fronting and having people who have in the paper share? Thank you very much, Jefferson, for allowing us to introduce the presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Minister, for the introduction. I'm not sure if you'd like to comment on the summary of the minister, but we're still going to have presentations to that effect. So we may try to interact with that one, but in the process of the presentation, we may find ourselves repeating our questions and concerns. I think I'm allowed that we continue the presentation. Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Minister. Can we have a presenter? Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honorable Chair, and thank you to the Minister. Chair, the first presentation is on the ratification of the International Telecommunications Union, Final Acts of 2010. Just to indicate my apologies, Chair, firstly, the apologies from the Director General of the Department, Mr. Robert Nguna. I think he sent through an official note to your office. He's not able to make it.
I'm just saying the Deputy Minister, I thought you were talking about that.
And yes, my apologies. Deputy Minister, Prof. Sengwe Mkhize, she also sent through an apology to your office. I think that is.
Okay.
My apologies for that. Chair, as I indicated, the first presentation is on the ratification of the ITU. Just to indicate that the presentation will be made by Mr. Jim Patterson. But in terms of the introductory, as we indicated in our last session on the ratifications, is that this is actually quite a strategic, important forum for us. And the work of ITU is closely linked to Chapter 4 of the NDP program, where we are looking at the development of the economic infrastructure, the Minister alluded to, especially when you're looking at the internet capacitating the fourth industrial revolution. With regard to the South African delegation that participated at the ITU in 2010, it was led by former Minister, the General Sphiwe Nyanda, and the delegation consisted of officials from then Department of Communications, as well as the Department of International Relations and Cooperation. We also had officials from the regulator, ICASA, as well as Centec, Telkom, MultiChoice, the Universal Service Agency, amongst the South African, consisting of the South African delegation. We had four national preparatory meetings, as well as SADC, which is the regional and the continental meetings held under ATU. And in totality, I think there were about 10 forums where we basically shaped what we call the African Common Position for the ITU. So I'm just going to ask Mr. Patterson to take us through in terms of the outcomes that we achieved at that conference and the reasons why we are ratifying them now.
Thank you, Nongkapela, and good morning, Chairperson and Minister and honourable members and observers. Okay, so the request is for Parliament to consider the approval of the ratification of the Plenipotentiary Conference of 2010 of the ITU. Looks like I've forgotten the beginning at the end. Okay. The Plenipotentiary Conference is a top policy-making body of the ITU, so it sets out the policy, the financial planning, and the strategic goals of the ITU. It also deals with elections, and it also deals with any amendments to the Constitution and Convention which govern how its 193 member states interact with each other within the ITU. It's held every 4 years, and it's really the main opportunity for member states to try and influence the strategic directions that the ITU takes and what it prioritizes in terms of shaping the future information and communication technology environment globally. So in terms of elections, it deals with the senior management team, which is the executive. That would be the Secretary General. Re-elected for the second time was Hamadoun Touré, the first African to lead the ITU, re-elected as his deputy was Holin Zhao of China, and for the first time we had two African leaders within the executive of the ITU. We also had Brahima Sanou of Burkina Faso. I think, as Nongkapela indicated, that the work of the ITU aligns closely with the National Development Plan, and of course it aligns closely with the foreign policy priority we give to strengthening the rules-based global system. Okay, so the key issues that were discussed, I think the Minister elaborated on some of these. One of the most important was resolutions around cybersecurity. There was a lot of concern, I think, amongst member states that they're investing a lot and encouraged to invest a lot in developing national ICT systems, you know, based on the rollout of broadband and rolling out internet. But there was a lot of sense that there's quite a lot of vulnerability around issues of cybersecurity. The ITU agreed to strengthen its cybersecurity agenda, its global cybersecurity agenda, and provide for capacity building and policy approaches that can be adopted by member states. I think key in this is the technical assistance that the ITU has offered to member states in terms of computer emergency response teams, or what other countries call computer security incidents response teams. You find regularly now that there's African drills on cybersecurity drills, which a lot of countries participate in, including South Africa, and many countries are following the model of establishing these computer emergency response teams. So a lot of the work that's been done has been adopted and is on an ongoing basis is being updated and improved with the assistance of the ITU. An old issue in the ITU was internet addressing. I think one of the key issues was country code top-level domain names, where some countries had felt that, including South Africa actually, that their domain name at one point was privatized by ICANN in the way it was allocated. and it was felt to be a public good, so that it needed to come back within the kind of publicly managed domain. And that happened anyway, but it's an ongoing discussion within the ITU. Then we also mentioned the International Telecommunications Regulations, which have since been ratified by Parliament in South Africa. At that point, we were discussing what the agenda would be, what would be on the agenda for the World Conference on International Telecommunications. We've already begun within the ITU discussion about the next World Conference on International Telecommunications and when it should be and what should be on the agenda of that conference in terms of updating the ITRs. So we'll probably be back here in about 20 years' time with a new set of ITRs to be ratified by Parliament. I think with the Internet, the key issue in the 2010 Plenary Potential Conference was a growing sense of member states not being able to interact too strongly on public policy issues, and there's a growing sense of the overlap between, or the technical overlap between the ITU and ICANN and others. There's a very strong interaction between these different bodies in terms of facilitating the development of the Internet. And generally it actually works well, but I think in terms of the public policy space, the ITU did agree that there would be there was a dedicated group looking at Internet public policy, so this was formally amended to become a council working group. So it just increased the status, I would say, of the ITU's work to address public policy around Internet and the management of Internet resources. Then there's also the issue, in fact, related to that of multilingual domain names that the Internet system needs to recognize different languages in terms of addressing. And then another quite important issue which was addressed for the first time at that plenipotentiary conference was on conformance and interoperability. This was a resolution that came out of the Johannesburg World Telecommunications Standardization Assembly, and it relates also to the following bullet point, bridging the standardization gap between developed and developing countries. The idea around the resolution on conformance and interoperability was to develop capacity, especially amongst developing countries, for testing IT equipment for conformance and interoperability to make sure it's compatible and it functions effectively with globally. So the idea was to provide for the possibility of developing regional testing centers, which would then maintain a database of ITU testing so that countries could see which equipment was in line with ITU standards on conformance and interoperability. And the ITU would then maintain a database of the recordings of the testings that have been done by internationally recognized testing facilities. So it's a project that's just still underway. It took quite a long time to take off. It was also quite controversial at some point, but now it seems to be moving a bit more swiftly. I think a lot of the concerns for developing countries was that they also didn't have a very good capacity for detecting fake equipment or dealing with equipment that was being dumped that was no longer meeting modern standards. So that was also one of the big concerns that was driving the need for conformance and interoperability testing. Human exposure to and measurements of electromagnetic fields. This resolution has been updated subsequently. It's an ongoing debate about whether there's harmful, or what are the harmful levels of electromagnetic fields, and whether they can be transmitted through ICT equipment or through base stations or broadcasting centers, or what would be the safe boundaries to operate for human beings. Then another key thing that the ITU has done is around child online protection. in a lot of these areas, such as child online protection, also in the case of climate change, IGU often produces handbooks to guide member states on what are the best policy approaches, the best practices to ensure that children can benefit from access to the internet but remain safe from some of the harmful consequences of doing so. There's an ongoing process of developing and updating and improving various products that the IGU has produced to assist with child online protection. And then similarly with telecommunications and ICT on climate change, there was a big drive to ensure more recognition of the application of ICTs to help ensure a more efficient utilization of energy resources, improved management of emissions, say from pollution, and also from cars, if you have smart traffic management systems. So that's an ongoing project at the IGU, but also the safe disposal of ICT equipment, which is, on the one hand, ICTs can help manage and produce favorable environmental results, but on the other hand, equipment also needs to be disposed of safely, and preferably rare earth metals and such can be recycled. Okay, we mentioned the ITRs already. And then ITU Telecom events, these are, it's a global kind of forum and conference that takes place every year now, and normally in Geneva, but often it's been moved to South Korea, I think, on a number of occasions, and other countries too. One of the features of the ITU Telecom world is, apart from the huge exhibition and the forum, is that the resources or net profits that are generated from it are supposed to go towards the ICT Development Fund to support the ITU's development agenda. I think at the beginning I probably should have just mentioned or repeated that the ITU is structured into three main parts. It has a standardization section, which is culmination of the World Telecommunications Standardization Assembly. I think the last took place just last year. You have the World Radio Conference, the radio communications sector, where we worry about how we allocate spectrum. And then we have the development sector, which looks then at what are the development priorities for the different regions of the ITU, and what are the key priority areas where the ITU should put in resources to help countries empower themselves in particular areas. And the development conference is this year, later this year, in 2017. So the resources from the telecom world events, go to support that development sector agenda, along with other resources that they managed to raise. And the minister also mentioned the free online access to ITU publications. I haven't checked the latest trend on this, but they did find at one point that by making some of their publications free, they were actually selling more copies subsequently. So by making it free to some of their members or to developing countries or so on, it's actually having a positive result in terms of promoting the ITU's work. So they actually, I would like to see if that trend is continuing or not, but certainly it did look positive in terms of resources. Then another part here was the admission of sector members from developing countries to participate in the work of the radio communications sector and the standardization sector. This was just to deal with the cost, I think, of participants from developing countries to participate in those sectors. The IGU has something called sector membership, so private companies from different countries can participate. Say, for example, if they're particularly interested in standardization, they can just participate in the standardization work of the ICU and just become a member for standardization, or they can become a member for the radio communication or development. But this was dealing with the cost, because the ITU uses this as a way of raising funds from the private sector, but the cost can be prohibitive to developing countries. So they wanted to encourage greater developing country participation. Okay, I don't think we need to go into the others. Okay, some of the key issues we were participating in was around internet governance and the child online protection. Also, we were active, it doesn't mention here, but on the conformance and interoperability testing and the issue of free access of ITU publications. Okay, and then in terms of the implications, I think the treaty is binding to all signatories, but I should say it's binding on those who, who ratify the treaty. And in terms of financial implications, we pay membership to the ITU of 1,272,000 Swiss francs per annum. And I think that's basically it. So, yes, we're requesting consideration for the ratification of the ITU Plenipot of 2010.
Thank you very much. I think we should have the next presentation so that when we ask questions and make comments, we'll do as one. But when we come to a panel of it, it will be done individually. I say we have to adopt them, but we're going to discuss them, adopt them individually, because we have two presentations there.
So
okay.
Can we discuss the treaty on the time before we go?
Okay, that's fine. I think we're not ready. Okay. In that order, I see all the hands. Okay. Honorable McKenzie, Honorable Sheen, Honorable Suela.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Mr. Patterson. In terms of the sessions and the way South Africa is seen at the ITU, are we rated as a developed or a developing country? And does that inform the position that we take? Thank you.
Thank you. I'm wanting to know whether you have taken note of the various concerns the legal advisors raised regarding, what is it here, Articles 23 to 30, deals with the finances of the union. We advise that the relevant authorities should be consulting regarding the final financial implications for South Africa. Has this been done? Have you discussed that with the budgetary or whoever needs to look at that? Then there was another concern, Articles 1 to 6. The Department is reminded that in trying to meet its obligations, there might be financial implications involved in the conferences and whatever. Have you budgeted for any of these? Have you worked out the costs? Are you planning those? And then the concerns about POPI regarding some of the implications of the agreement. Then what is the annual fee? Did you say what the annual fee was to belong? And I presume you'd be budgeted for that. And how many member states have already ratified this? I know there were plenty of signatories, but how many of them have actually ratified the thing? Then internet governance. There was an AU Internet Governance Treaty. Was it a treaty or was it an agreement? That was, when I last checked about 2 years ago, it hadn't been ratified by anybody. Can you please explain what has happened to that? Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. Two quick questions from me. What is the benefit? Can the department explain in simple terms the benefit of this kind of these treaties? And two, has the department implemented any of the resolutions mentioned above? Thank you.
If you are done with questions, can we get responses?
Thank you very much to the honourable members for the questions. And if I can just respond to some, and I'll ask Mr. Patterson to respond as well. With regard to the POPI Act as well as the alignment, we do make sure that there is an alignment process. I think when we are looking at the National Cyber Security Bill, we actually have to make sure that we incorporate the ITU principles or the global principles. And with regard to the budgeting of the membership contribution, Honourable Shin, it is correct that we are paying 1.2 as a country. And although it is coming from the department, I just want to emphasize the benefits, as Mr. Patterson indicated, that we are talking about spectrum issues for the entire country, cross-cutting to a number of sectors. We're talking about the developmental agenda, both for the country as well as for regional issues. And then obviously then we are talking about the issues of standardization is quite critical to us. We are working with the likes of CSIR as well as the South African Bureau of Standards together with ICASA to make sure that we put South Africa as perhaps one of the regional conformance and interoperability testing centers. We do believe that if you're then going to move into an innovative and technology-developed country, we really need to start looking at building our own capabilities in this area. And then with regard to the AU Convention on Cybersecurity and the Protection of Personal Data, which the heads of state adopted in 2014 in Malan, Guinea, 8 member states have signed the treaty to date, and one has ratified. That was the status that we had received from the AU at the end of 2016. For South Africa as well, I think the process is that, one, it has to be deposited through the, for us to receive the document through the diplomatic channels. One, we have not received it as yet. And then secondly, we also need to check it, as I indicated, against our own national cybersecurity bill. When we went to the AU for this, because we were advancing this as the sector together with our colleagues from Justice as well as from the state security, we had advocated for a framework because we thought that countries are at different levels with regard to the development of their cybersecurity, and we also had the POPI Act. But the AU felt that they wanted to have a convention on this issue, in this area. So we then are in a situation of trying to assess and to study the document and ensure that there's alignment so that when we do ratify, because you can't ratify with reservations, when we do ratify, then as the country, we are committing to fully align ourselves with all the articles. The importance of it, I think, we're notwithstanding that, because it's important that as a region, as Mr. Patton said, that we have a platform of coordination, especially when it comes to issues of cybercrime. So that is the one element that we do not want to lose sight of in the midst of us advancing this program. With regard to, I'm going to ask Mr. Patterson to respond on the legal advisors. From the state law advisors. But just to state again that we would not be able to proceed with the ratification if there were still contested issues that have a bearing with regard to our domestic national policy.
There was also the question about are we rated, developed or developing, and does that inform our positions? I don't think, an ITU doesn't make a classification directly in terms of whether we're developed or developing. They're, Their main concern would be then, are they least developed countries? We see ourselves within the ICU as part of the Africa group. So our positions are very strongly informed by developing country needs. And there is quite a strong focus within a lot of UN-based organizations on regional development and regional organizations. So we focus quite strongly on developing common African positions where possible. They're not compulsory, but that's a general position that we will try and do. If we can't reach consensus, then you can't necessarily do that for everything, but that would be the general approach. I was just trying to get the... Sorry, I wasn't quite quick enough to write down, I think it's mentioned all the articles you were referring to about the financial implications. Sorry, could you just repeat the articles you were making reference to from the legal opinion? Is this the legal opinion from Justice, I think?
Yeah.
On the financial implication, of course, if you are hosting something like a conference, that's the first thing you have to motivate from the cabinet, because we don't host these things just for the hosting of them. We have to motivate why he's going to help the country and how much he's going to spend. If the organization is going to contribute, what is their actual contribution? And that's what takes quite a lot of attention from cabinet, because we're very wary of this organization dumping responsibilities on us, which may not give us any benefit. I think that's a broad context, that whenever we do something, we must clearly indicate what are the financial implications. I think that's what they were highlighting, that hosting, I don't think we've hosted at all. But we do hold some of the workshops or things like that, but because it's an international body, we have got an agreement from government to intervene. Some of the things like technical committees, which don't cost us much, but anything which is going to cost us money, because some of the costs may not just be hiring the conference hall. We have to secure these people when they come in. And it's got huge implications. For example, just put an example on the police. So the Department of International Relations Cooperation led a team with the police, can't remember that department, which was really putting us guidelines for hosting international events. I'm just putting that as an example. So all of us, because we've adopted those guidelines, we must comply with them. And I can tell you some of the nice international events, they get shut down because of that, because we've experienced most countries, they host this thing and they left bankrupt. So that's why even, I'm just using a 2010, there was such stringent management of that thing with all the problems, but I think we did much well because it was greater coordination from national government to local government. On how we actually manage this thing, that it doesn't leave us with a huge debt. So I'm just putting that as an example, maybe to say financial implications, they always have to be clearly indicated before any approval of hosting of this event. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you, Minister. Yes, I think that's correct. The real obligation we have is membership, and that's something that you can change by notifying the next plenipotentiary conference of your intention to do so. Any other financial obligation is really optional. It's about what you decide to do with what you've agreed that the ICU should do. So if the ICU is going to put resources into this or this particular area, how much you want to participate in that work is where you start incurring some financial implications, like attending meetings or hosting meetings or providing to voluntary funds or whatever. I think it's about what you put in and what you get out. All right, thank you.
The last question, I think it was coming from Honorable Sowela with regard to the benefits as well as the implementation of the resolution. We do make sure that when we do come back from the ITU, we engage with the relevant entities, and especially I think in this area it would be CASA in terms of alignment. But as a department, for example, on the issues related to your child online, we had guidelines and we engaged them with the CASA, so they've been incorporated in terms of the work at CASA. With regards to your ITRs, as we indicated last year, we are incorporating it within the ICT ICT policy white paper, especially the areas with regard to your transparency of your wholesale pricing, and that has also been included within the CASA when it comes to the issues of monitoring the cost, not just in terms of roaming, but your international mobile telecommunications. And then on the internet protocol base, as well as the issues of the domain name, domain name registry, ZACR, they've also incorporated that. I think we do try to promote, although we are quite back as a country in terms of the areas of the multilingual, but as you can see that on the global internet issues, you are able to get like Google in isiZulu, isiXhosa, and what have you not in the translation. But when we are, the programs that we're doing with regards to the dot cities, with regards to Cape Town, we are trying to promote our indigenous languages to make sure that, because we want to reach as many citizens as possible. The human exposure issues in terms of the electronic magnetic fields, ICASA has got the guidelines with regard to that, and I indicated the guidelines as well with regard to protection of child online. On the issues related to climate change, we're also working with the Department of Environmental Affairs in terms of making sure that we do not contribute any further with regard to your ozone deficiencies. So in response, there are a number of programs that we do make sure as a country that are critical to us, that we ensure that there's implementation of it. And not only that, you have regional meetings post each conference where you are assessing progress with countries that you're able to submit the information to. And as we are now preparing for the ITU plenipotentiary in 2018, we need to make sure that has been progress for us so that we can then move to the next layer of the global challenges that are facing us to be able to address and mitigate those. Thank you.
Are we done with questions? I think we are happy with the responses, so that's why we do not have follow-up questions. And in the absence of any further questions, we now move to the adoption of this presentation or report. But before adopting it, we need to formalize it by reading this briefing that I'm going to read now. Then we move for the adoption. A report of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services on the final act of the Plenipotentiary Conference of the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, dated 15 November 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, having considered the final act of the Plenipotentiary Conference of the International Telecommunications Union, Utalajara 2010, tabled in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, 1996, and Extraterritorial Memo thereto, referred to it, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 2312 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Can we now move for the adoption of the report? Honorable Sowela?
I move that the report be adopted.
Any second now?
No, I'm not taking
it. Oh, sorry. While you're waiting for a second,
I'm not taking it. Okay.
I just make sure that any other hands for adoption. Honorable Tetabase? You not? Okay. Representative is noted, and what regime?
can you please note that the DA reserves its opinion on this, pending a decision by our caucus?
That is noted. Thank you. Can we get to the other presentation? In the meantime, we'll have to go to the other presentation. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Honourable Chair, and to the Honourable Members. And without necessarily wasting time on this, I think the Minister did allude to the fact as to why we're bringing this matter now for the ratification of the African Telecommunications Union Convention of 1999. There was an issue, I think, in South Africa we've been pressing for the African Telecommunications Union Secretariat to enter into a formal agreement with the AU in order for us as a country to be able to move forward on this recognition. I think we just to indicate to members that, I mean, when you're trying to discuss this matter with other regional members or member states, it becomes very difficult when you are one voice. But South Africa was successful in terms of making sure that there is that bridge MOU that was signed between the ATU and the AUC, or African Union Commission, which was in 2012. So that is why then we're able then to commence with this particular ratification, which was, I know it's understandably that it was almost 10 years later. I'm going to ask Ms. Zanele Malcolm to take us through the presentation very quickly. I think it's a straightforward matter. Thank you.
Thank you, Honourable Chair. Thank you, Minister. And also thank you, members, for this opportunity. Just to highlight briefly, or just to add in terms of the background, that South Africa took a decision to join the ATU, which is in line with the foreign policy objective of pursuing the developmental agenda and promoting the African renaissance, including strengthening African institutions and prioritizing Africa. Also, to indicate that South Africa is one of the 45 member states of ATU, having signed the ATU Convention and Constitution in 1999 during the Extra Plenipot Conference, which was hosted here in Cape Town. And also to indicate that from the information that we have received early last year, that about 27 countries have ratified. And also to indicate that it was at the same meeting in 1999 whereby the same forum that had to transform the what commonly known as PATU, the Pan-African Telecommunications Union, which its primary focus is it was to coordinate bodies for government-related activities and the transformation set to include the primary and the public stakeholder in the information of technology sector. Sorry, let me pull this. It's a bit too far from me. And the main question is as to why now. As the Minister has alluded that the delay of the ratification was due to legal clarification on the recognition of the specialized technical agencies of the OAU under the AU. I think it has been explained that currently the ATU is currently recognized as a specialized agency for implementation of AU ICT programs. And also to indicate that South Africa is also intending to put up a candidatures for elective positions at ITU and also for in ATU in next year, 2018. And also to indicate that South Africa remains active, more especially in the spectrum programs and coordinating, having served as a chapter coordinator and rapporteur for Africa, and still serve in the African Working Group for World Radio Communication Conference, the world commonly known as WRC. And also the DDG, ADDG International, has alluded that the work of R2 is aligned, closely aligned with Chapter 4 and 7 of the NDP. And maybe one might ask, what are the key focus and benefit of ratifying this, the R2? It's also one point that the minister, I think, has alluded as well, highlighted unto it, is that R2 is a strategic linkage with ITU. And one of the primary focus areas for the country is to advance South African satellite ambition through the ITU. And also, we feel that any country wanting to launch a satellite, the application for satellite launch is made with the ITU and must be received, and it should receive and get endorsement from member states. Therefore, are to provide a network platform and support in this regard. And also to further to indicate that in terms of infrastructure, R2 coordinate ICT infrastructure programs and priorities such as submarine cables, terrestrials, network and satellite technology, so to ensure effective interconnectivity within a country and between countries, region, and also the continent. Also to indicate that in terms of benefit, we have the human resource development. R2 reaffirms the centrality of HRDs in the development processes. Also to indicate that R2 focuses, amongst others, on the development of massive e-awareness campaigns and establishment of e-learning network in Africa, and also to indicate that the business and industry development also are to recognize the role and the public-private partnership both at the national and also international level. And as ADG International also indicated, that the support and inclusion of industry and its program for ICT development and continues to forge alliance among African ICT business sectors. And also to add maybe the ICT content development, R2 emphasizes on the need for local content development to ensure the universality of benefits of ICT, thus preserving and enriching the cultural and national heritage of nations. Therefore, R2 is a strategic organization that South Africa would like to use as an influence platform for the telecommunications ICT development in Africa. And also to indicate that South Africa remains active in R2 forums by providing guidance, strategic leadership, and taking up a leadership role and responsibility. Currently, as a country, we serve in R2 administration executive council. One might also indicate in terms of the financial implications, as indicated in, I think it's Article 1-6 of the Justice. Sorry. Yeah. There are no financial implications with respect to ratifying the convention article. However, South Africa, through the department, may be requested to host meetings or conferences of R2, and should such requests be made, the department will follow all necessary protocol requirements in hosting in line with the applicable legislation governing such request. And also to indicate that currently the department on behalf of the country pays membership fee as a standard obligation by all member states and associate members. The current membership, which is the department is paying, is about $75,000 per annum. In terms of the implication, it also good to indicate that the department will follow the processes of ratifying as guided by the Office of the Chief State Law Advisor and also DECOM. And also in terms of organization, the department will continue to serve in the INR2 Administrative Council and actively participate in the relevant R2 forums, I think.
Sorry, may I just add?
Maybe Chair. Did you to add?
Chair, just to indicate with regard to our membership, at the last plenipotentiary conference, which was in 2014, we took a decision as a country to reduce our membership. It was at 86,500, and we had a new revised scale of contributions, and we then revised it down to $75,000. However, we also engaged our sectors because they also similar have sector membership participation. We then engaged our sectors, MTN and Vodacom, to also join R2, which they did, and therefore it was able, as a country, holistically, we're sitting at 100,000 in terms of membership contributions, coupled with the two that one is contributing 15,000 and the other one is 10,000 US dollars annually. I think Honorable Shin, when she was asking about that, we are in a process with the current economic climax of reviewing. So we obviously, in each of the international bodies that we're members of, we will engage our sectors and take that conscious decision as to how much we can all equally share on that. So that is something that we are also trying to address within the other international bodies which we are members. Thank you.
Can we then interact with the presentation, questions or comments? Over McKenzie.
Thank you, Chair. I'm not sure if you can answer this this question. The ATU, it's been around for a while, since 1999 or before. Can you just see how effective the body is? Can you give me some examples of human resource development undertaken by the ATU for its members? And business and industry development, just an example there, and ICT content development. If you have that information to hand, that would be useful. Thank you, Chair.
In the absence of another question, can we allow the presenter to respond to the question?
Thank you, Chair. If I may, thank you very much to Honorable McKenzie on that. With regard to the business development, you may find that there are new technologies. I'll make an example of the company called Qualcomm, which is which is an associate member also of R2. So if you are then going to be either piloting or pioneering new technologies that you would want to, they actually bring it within that forum, identify countries where they would like to pilot that in order then to raise both awareness, obviously for them it's commercial, but I think it would be beneficial for countries. So the areas of like your smart schools, smart learnership or smart classrooms, they've actually been doing that. They do it in South Africa, but they've also been doing it in other countries as well, such as Uganda and others. So that's the area where I talk about in terms of business development. But we also, for us, you also then would find that you have research academic institutions that are also part of that, so they will actually contribute as well in the areas of research for the continent as well, in where we'd want to explore areas. With regard to your ICT content, there is, which may not be as popular, they've tried to develop an online platform which is similar to your, forgotten this, it's not Tech Central, the other one, IT Web, but they've done a continental one where then they're trying to also put in newsletters from each of the respective countries just for the African community to continue sharing information as to what's happening in terms of the development in the respective countries. Thank you very much, Honorable Shin, for that assistance. And then with regards to your HRD, they have capacity building programs quite regularly, especially I think in the areas of spectrum. So training, like there was one end of this end of January, and then they will also partner again with international institutions to provide that those training capacity building programs initiatives within the continent. And they, as I said, they vary, but most of the time they would be in the areas of spectrum management, spectrum planning, as well as auditing to build that capacity within the continent. Thank you.
Thank you very much. In the absence of any other follow-up question, we'll follow the same procedure. Can I read? Report of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services on the Constitution and Convention of the African Telecommunications Union, ATU, dated 15 November 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, having considered the Constitution and Convention of the African Telecommunications Union, ATU, tabled in terms of Section 231, Bracket 2 of the Constitution, 1996, and extraordinary memo thereto, referred to it, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Bracket 2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. Can you move for the adoption? Honorable Suelo?
I move that the report be adopted.
Seconder? In the absence of anyone seconding, we'll pass this in the meantime and continue with other business of the committee until we form a quorum again and go back to them. Thank you. Let's get to the representation. Thank you very much for the presentation, and through the questions that the members are asking, it gives us more clarity on the issues that we do not understand. And I think we can, maybe in the meantime, deal with the other one when the other members are coming to join us. Can we just have patience a little bit? We have members coming to join us, and we form again the quorum. In the meantime, can we hand over to BEE to make a presentation? Are we ready?
They're setting up, Chair.
Can I question you up front before you make a presentation that as soon as we form a quorum again, we'll ask you to stop a little bit as we continue the adoption, then you continue again, because we are taking members from other committees, so we cannot hold them here for a long time.
Thank no you. Problem. Thank you, Chair. I think just to give a brief background whilst they are setting up, it won't be part of the presentation. Just allow me to give you the process, because I remember the how we went about the whole code alignment. And when we get the presentations, there will be areas that I will skip because I would have already spoken to them. If you allow me, Chairperson, to do that, then we can save time. Good morning, Chairperson, Minister, honorable colleagues, the industry representatives, and councillors. My name is Nokuzola Ahrens. I'm the Chairperson of the ICT Sector Council. I just want to give you a brief background on how we came about. We were actually appointed on the 24th of September. If you remember, it was a public holiday with a mandate to start on the 1st of October. Our other mandate was to actually align the ICT sector code by the 30th of September. Otherwise, it was going to be repealed. The task was quite a mammoth one because already in May 2015, the IT Web has given us a fail because they didn't believe that the ICT sector will be still in existence. So I just want to give that bit of background to show that whatever work we did in a month of existence, we really tried our utmost. And because of the expertise that we brought into the council, it made our life a lot easier. And where possible, we did engage with the industry. We did take all the comments, inputs from the industry, but
the final analysis was to actually promote transformation. So not all the inputs that we received were what the industry wanted us to do, but we were also making sure that we are serving transformation in the country. So in going to the table of contents, I think you do have the presentation in front of you. As part of the introduction, that's the brief background that I've given you. And I would also like to mention that after aligning the code, we did have consultation with the industry because we submitted on the 30th, on the 29th of October. The DTI, we had to submit to our minister first, who gave us the go-ahead and supported our submission to the DTI minister, who actually came back and gave us 2 weeks' grace up to the 15th of November to consult the industry, because whilst we were aligning the codes, we did not get enough time to consult our industry first. After we did that, the DTI accepted our proposal, and they actually gazetted it for public comment in February, the 25th of February. There was a mistake in that gazette, and they actually corrected it on the 29th of February. For the 60-day submission and comment period, it ended in April the 29th. So whatever we did, it was informed by the industry inputs and also by public comments. We took everything into consideration, and we do have records. Okay, as I said, that we were actually constituted on the, established on the 24th of September with our first meeting on the 1st of October. The minister made it clear that they are not going to tell us who the chairperson or the deputy chairperson is going to be, but the committee itself must decide on who is going to be the chairperson and the deputy chair. We couldn't do that in our first sitting because we didn't know one another, although we came from the industry. So the DTPS secretariat had to act as chair. We went through the work of doing our constitution, and that was the first task that the council had. And at the end of that work, we managed to get a chairperson and the deputy chair. I'm the chairperson, and Mr. Tyler is the deputy chairperson as a result of that. I'm at your service, Chair.
Okay, we'll suspend the presentation for a while and get into the business of the adoption of the two presentations. And I'll have to read afresh what I have read before. I wish my machine could share with us why they are not adopting this one. Say just the mandate of the caucus. If they're doing anything wrong, in future we'll improve. But if you don't tell us why, we're going to do the same thing next time we meet again. So you'll decline. So just appealing to you that if you can be kind enough and towards the end of the meeting, maybe you share with us when we're in a formal meeting as to why you are not supporting. Okay, let me reread. And to save time again, I think we should also deal with the minutes so that when we're done here, we don't have a problem with the quorum again. Thank you, Member Nguyeni. Sorry to abuse you today. Let me reread. The report of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services on the final act of the Plenipotentiary Conference of the International Telecommunications Union, ITU, dated 15 November 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, having considered the final act of the Plenipotentiary Conference of the International Telecommunications Union, Portal Ajaram, 2010, tabled in terms of Section 231, Subject 2 of the Constitution, 1996, an explanatory memo thereto referred to it, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231, Subject 2 of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. So we then move for the adoption. Honorable Ndonyeni and Seconda. Honorable Suwela. The report is duly adopted. Member Shin.
Thank you, Chair. Please, can you note that the DA reserves its position on these these conventions? We need to consult our caucus.
That is noted. Let's come to the second one, as we have engaged with it already. Report of the Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services on the Constitution and Convention of the African Telecommunications Union, ATU, dated 15 November 2016. The Portfolio Committee on Telecommunications and Postal Services, having considered the Constitution and Convention of the African Telecommunications Union, ATU, tabled in terms of Section 231, bracket 2 of the Constitution, 1996, an explanatory memo thereto, referred to it, recommends that the House, in terms of Section 231(2) of the Constitution, approve the said agreement. So we move for adoption. Honorable Suela. Any seconder? Honorable Ndonyani, thank you very much. The two presentations are duly adopted, and Member Shin, let's come to now.
Thank you, Chairperson. Please note that the DA reserves its position on these. We need to consult our caucus.
Noted. Can we quickly come to minutes? I think we have received the two sets of minutes. If we can deal with them, I think members have gone through them. At least today we don't have a pile. We can just quickly peruse and... We have minutes of the 8th November 2016 and 15 November 2016. Can you start with the one of 8th November, page 1? All names spelled correctly. Page 2. Page 3. Page 4. Page 5. Page 6. And page... Oh, Honorable Shin. Oh, Mr. McKenzie, I'm so upset.
That's fine. You can see why. thank you, Chair. Chair, just the spelling of my name on the second last paragraph on the page with the S instead of a Z. Z is very important. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much for that correction. In the absence of any corrections or comments on the minutes, can we move for adoption of the minutes? Honorable McKenzie, Honorable Kitabashe, thank you very much. Can we then come to the last set, 15 November 2016? Is McKenzie correctly written now? Is correct? Page 2. Page 3, page 4, page 5, page 6, done with that one line in page 7. Can you move for adoption of the minutes? Thank you very much. We are done with the minutes, and thank you very much, Mundungeni. We need to come back to the committee. Please. Okay. Thank you very much. Okay. Can we then go back to the presentation? Thanks, Otore. Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Chairperson. I've already mentioned that we were established on the 24th of September, and I've given you the work that we've done up until the first gazetting for public comment in February, which was closed in April. And then we also submitted to the DTI, who actually gazetted the final code on the 7th of November. On the 8th of November, the Minister, Honorable Dr. Siyabonga Gcwele, launched the ICT Sector Council, although the people say he launched the code. He actually launched the council on the 8th of November last year. Now, in between, we actually took it upon ourselves to support the department by providing the first monitoring report for the end of March 2015. And what we managed to do, or 2016, and what we managed to do there, we actually worked very closely with our verification agencies, SANAS, and the industry, where we requested that together with the BEE certificates, there's a report that verification agencies provide. And we asked for copies of those reports. We didn't want to know which companies they were coming from, but we wanted just to get the statistics, so we were collecting data. And the verification agencies and some companies did comply and provided us with the reports, which we compiled a report that the minister managed to get some information for the budget vote speech in 2016. So that work is continuing. If we go to the introduction, you'll see that since our establishment, we've been consulting the ICT industry as part of the process in the amended sector code, and we also finalized the code, and then we also did another interim report for October last year. So what we're doing is from the first set of statistics, we added more companies because we are looking for a pool of data that will give us enough substance in order to do the analysis. And all we're looking at is how the sector is actually transforming or is actually complying with the code. So we managed to engage a lot with the industry stakeholders, where companies came to us asking for assistance and clarification on the code, and we managed to do our best in explaining what we mean by ownership. Because we did have a problem where some companies started formulating trusts which were not part of ownership, and we had to explain what constitutes ownership. In our current code, or the gazetted code, if you have a trust that doesn't have shareholders into your company and doesn't pay dividends to individuals as empowerment, we cannot see that under ownership. It is only a trust, and we give it 3 points or 3% of ownership. So this is why we had to engage with the industry to make them understand, because the industry will say, we've got 30+1% shareholding from this trust, and we're paying the money into the trust so that they can educate black people or they can educate girls. That is not constituting ownership, and that's the way that we are actually making sure that we enforce compliance with the code. The other area that we're trying to promote is the SMME, where we believe that if there are companies that are 51% black owned or 51% black woman owned, they should be considered for supplier development or enterprise development. And these are the areas that the council is trying to ensure that industry supports. We are even in a process through our secretariat to collect those companies so that when industry says they can't get the right partnerships, we can provide the partnerships. After the launching of our code, or the final gazetting of our code, we are now faced with a roadshow where we want to go to all provinces, engage all the stakeholders, who actually comprise of, if you go to page 5 or page 6 of the presentation, you'll see that these are the areas that constitute the ICT sector, which is broadcasting subsector, electronics, telecommunications, information technology, the regulator, and the government. Organized labor and social partners consisting of people with disability, youth, women. Now, out of these groups, we have 16 members. If you go to the next page, which is page 7, it gives you all the names of the councillors and the areas where that they are representing. But we need to make it clear that some of the nominations came from the associations and from the industry. However, as councillors, we're not only serving the interest of those people that nominated us into the council. However, we are serving the interest of the entire industry. So we are no longer seen as just a person coming from this association, but we are there looking after the interest of the entire industry. And that's why even our associations, we try to make them understand that it's not like we owe them anything. We were appointed as councillors based on the experience that we have in the industry and also the knowledge that we'll be bringing across in order to transform the industry. Now, if I may go back to page 4 of the presentation. I don't think they're able to project it. So, Minister, I hope you have a copy. Okay. Thank you, Minister. You are a true ICT minister. Thank you. Okay, the objectives of the council, just for your understanding, is that we are the custodian of the ICT sector code. We do advise organs of state, especially the DTI, the BEE Commission. We work very closely with them. And also we monitor and review the implementation of the ICT sector code as related matters, especially in the industry. So we have actually asked companies who claim to have a certain formulation of ownership to come and present to us how that ownership is formed and be able to advise them if it's what we consider as true ownership or not. And some companies most of the time have missed the point and had to go back to the drawing board and reformulate the ownership because it doesn't comprise as true ownership. That's why I was actually alluding to the trust, that some of them have used the trust because they believe they can quickly get the point. However, if we're really serious about ownership, we have to make sure that we constitute it properly. And the other thing is that for BEE compliance, companies are not forced. This is a voluntary act, and if you choose to do it, we ensuring that you're doing it properly as an industry. So this is where our thing is. We don't force you to take up BEE, but if you want to do it because it will benefit your company, please ensure that it is done according to the code. And we are the custodian of the code, and we will be in a position to say, yes, you've done it properly, or no, you haven't. And then we develop and foster common standards and code of ethics in the implementation of the code. This is why we work very closely with the verification agencies through SANAS. We engage with them in their workshops and we explain to them where the areas of difficulties that we have so that they can educate the industry as they're doing carrying out the verifications. And then we also assess, evaluate, and commission research on specific areas. I've already mentioned that we had the first monitoring report on the 31st of March, a second one end of October. Now we have got to produce one for end of March 2017. Now, this is informed by the information that we get from the industry via the verification agencies, and the companies that really are supporting the work of the council are coming forward to freely give us the information, but we still have problems with those companies who feel they don't have to share that information with us. It is a challenge, we are still new, but we will convince them that it is for their own good because we want to give a clear and informed statistics on which companies or which areas of the codes are being complied with and which areas are problematic so that together we can find answers. We are here to work with the industry, not to police them. So that's why we try and make sure that we get rid of all the smoke and mirrors and we remove anything to do with funding, because that is working against the transformation agenda. We provide guidance on sector-specific matters affecting BEE entities, and we also do the reports. I mean, we are currently discussing with the ministry that we have to provide a transformation survey of the top 100 companies. It is a task that the council can carry out. However, as the minister said, we are very poorly resourced, and minister, we will definitely need help when it comes to that, because it's work that when we provide a report, we want to give you the assurance that it has been informed and we can vouch with each and every information that informed it. So that's why we believe we will be in a position to provide it ourselves. And then we oversee, supervise, and promote adherence to the code. We have consultations and roadshows educating industry and affected parties on the implementation of the code and also what the benefits are going to be. Companies have approached us, and we have approached companies because we believe it's an interaction. It's not just us telling them what to do or them demanding what has to happen with the code. So this is work in progress. We strengthen and foster collaboration between the public and private sector. That's why the minister said, even if it's something that looks as if it's just for the private sector, the public sector is equally obliged to comply. So we are not going to pull any punches. We are going to make sure that everybody in the ICT sector comply with the ICT sector code as per the DTI's directive. And then we maintain a registry of major broad-based economic empowerment transactions in the sector. And these are the things that we actually will share with the sector. So when we do provide or produce a report, we will even go to the sector to say, do come and advertise, because it's something that you can carry and you can use to inform how you are running the company or to inform how you are transforming the country. So I think I've actually covered most of the areas, and I would like the Deputy Chairperson to also speak to the actual code changes that we've made.
Thanks, Chair. Thanks. Good morning, Honourable Members. I think the first thing, just quickly, is to indicate that this House approved the amendments to the BBBE Act of 2013. Our code is designed to implement that act. As a council, our responsibility does not only rest in the implementation of the code, but it also touches on other areas around transformation within the ICT sector. However, our work in the past 18 months has literally been focused on the implementation of the ICT sector code, which is a specific instrument to implement the BEE Act that you approved. The way the code is structured in such a way that it has five elements, and those elements are basically your ownership. It's not in the presentation, it's just a high-level summary. It's basically your ownership of companies. In other words, the extent to which black people, in terms of the act, own and control companies in the sector. The second one is management control. That is to the extent of measuring the extent of black people managing the operations of companies in the sector. And then the third one is skills development, the extent to which companies, public, private, implement skills development to designated people, including specifically black people and generically African people. And last but not least is a new concept called enterprise supplier development, whereas the old act focused on enterprise development, which means just starting companies without seeing them and don't even care what happens to them. Our amended code now talks to not only establishing of startup companies, but ensuring that companies can improve their capability to be part of the supplier value chain and also increase the procurement value. So that's the new concept of enterprise supplier development. The last one is the socio-economic development, which is focuses on bringing people into the mainstream ICT economy. In fact, the best way to look at our code is to look at it from the bottom, that the intention is to start encouraging people in rural areas, township, in underserviced areas, to give them entry into the sector, then help them either start up companies, bring them into the value chain, or skill them, and then hopefully if they want to be employed in companies, get them employed and own companies. So in a nutshell, those are the five areas. Out of those five, the emphasis really in this amendment is on SMME development. As a council, we believe that SMME development plays a critical role in a sector. It touches a lot of areas in terms of our value chain. That's why out of the 130 points that are allocated on all the five elements, SMME development accounts for 50 points, something that has been welcomed by a lot of SMMEs in the sector. We also go further, not just promoting those SMMEs. We encourage them to do joint venture partnerships with large companies that get awarded contracts by what is often called tier two suppliers. These are large suppliers that a lot of telecoms companies contract with. So we encourage them to do joint ventures. We encourage them to do partnerships with a lot of black-owned companies. I think I will end there, except just to point out that what is also unique with our code, other than the other codes, is that under skills development, we've actually ensured that on an annual basis, the sector must spend at least 2.2 billion rand at minimum if the entire sector has to comply with 40% of those points to designated groups, something that is only unique to our sector because we recognize that our sector is largely driven by specific skills that individuals must possess in order for them to go into the mainstream ICT. I will end there. Thanks, Chair. Thanks, everyone.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Minister.
Thank you for taking us through. There's the presentation. Members, can we engage? Over Mackenzie, over Sheen, over Suela.
Thank you, Chairperson. Thank you, Ms. Ahrens, for the presentation. In terms of trust ownership, what informs your position on trusts? Is that, does that come from the DGI or from somewhere else, or is that something that you've discussed amongst yourselves as a council and got that position? Let me tell you why I asked that. In terms of employee ownership of companies, trusts are a very useful mechanism of you know, making sure that employees participate or women-owned groups, for example. But it is one way of ensuring that the shares are not sold externally outside of the company. So it keeps the shares, or trusts, I always saw that as a vehicle for keeping the shareholding of the company within the company, if you see what I mean. So if you could just answer that. Then in terms of ownership of listed companies, how do you work out the ownership of a listed company? Telkom is one example, Vodacom, MTN. Given that those shares are fluid, they're constantly changing hands, and of course you've got the PIC stake in a lot of these companies. When you say you on your slide on page 3, you consulted with the ICT industry. Can you give me, and I'm thinking specifically of IT companies here that you consulted with, and did you consult with foreign-owned IT companies? And I use IBM as an example of that. You say the composition of the council represents a broad spectrum of stakeholders in the ICT sector, and then you list your councillors. Can you tell me which companies or which organizations each of these, it's quite a long question, each of these councillors belong to? I'm just trying to get an idea of interest.
and then the remuneration of councillors, and who pays? Where does your budget come from? Thank you, Chairperson.
Through you, Chair.
Okay.
Thank you, Chairperson. You said that you had much discussion with the ICT sector on their views of the code, and I'm wanting to know what concerns they expressed to you that you have been unable to accommodate, and why you've been unable to accommodate those. You talked specifically a lot about SME development. Well, the qualifying small enterprises, those with turnover of less than 50 million, I think their black beneficiaries have to be 75% of the company, which would mean that very few of those companies would qualify on a service one, level one qualification, which would surely exclude a lot of emerging small companies to be part of the, if I could say, we'll call it procurement chain. So that to me would seem to be counter to what you're actually trying to achieve. Then you talk about this register of the small companies, the 51% black-owned, woman-owned companies. You're going to form a register of these, and that ICT companies that can't find their own small companies on this level will then be able to consult this register. What are you seeing, how will you verify the skills level of these people? And when are you going to compile this register? When will it be available for ICT companies to consult with it? Then obviously the main problem with the ICT sector, and they've been screaming about this for years, is the shortage of appropriately skilled people. Now, most of these people require maths and science degrees, or at least a matric, and you know, there just aren't those people around. What are you doing to engage perhaps the Department of Basic Education to make sure that it actually boosts the caliber of its maths and science education, and thereby boost the level of potential qualifying people for the sector?
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson, for the opportunity. As the Council is doing its work, I would like to know what has the Council identified as practical challenges to ensure that the BBBEE code is adhered to, and that there is a clear benefit to small business. Thank you, Chairperson.
Thank you, Chair. It was just only two questions. What are the incentives of the participating in the code? Since this is voluntarily, I'm sorry. You understand the question, eh?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yes, I do.
Thank you. Has there been any interaction between the council and the code's beneficiaries, such as SMEs, in order to highlight the benefit of the code and how it can improve small businesses? Thanks, Chair.
Okay, phew, that's a long list. Well, it's like eating an elephant. It's one bite at a time. Okay, I will take some of the questions and the DC will take others. Okay, when it comes to the trust, the one thing that we actually noticed is that when we talk of ownership, we mean people that are part of the company. If you look at the breakdown of ownership, they have to have voting rights in the company, and you get points for them having voting rights in the company, and people that will actually impact the company's operations in order to benefit the company. That's number one. That's what we feel that the trusts are not bringing across, because the ones that we've engaged with, the companies that we've engaged with that are using trusts, we found that the trust is actually promoting like an equity equivalent type of investment, where the trust is educating people. It could be black people, it could be black girls, and the trust will second a trust member to the board, but that trust member doesn't have a vote, and that is not aligning with the ownership that we're looking for. So if we say ownership, you have to have shareholding, you have to be paid dividends, and that is what constitutes true ownership, which the trusts are not actually visibly showing us. That's the one thing. And then when it comes to the ownership, we've got two types of ownership. We have the equity equivalent programs, because what we're saying is some companies are not able to give shares to locals, but they are able to set aside a portion of their revenue to drive transformation. IBM comes into mind, where they've got an equity equivalent program where they actually are educating a number of university students, and those students are not part of the they don't come back and actually work for IBM. But that program has been approved by the DTI before our time, and this is the example of what the equity equivalent program does, and hence it's counted as ownership. Now the second one is, we've had companies that want to do equity equivalent investment programs, however, they have done ownership, the multinationals, they have done ownership in other countries where they operate. Now the DTI has specifically said, because our mandate, remember, is from the DTI, they are the overall owners of BEE, hence the BEE Commission and the BEE Act. Now, the DTI stated that if you have given ownership in countries where you are not, it's not your home country, then you cannot say when you come to South Africa you're not going to do ownership. So the fact that you've done it in other countries, it forces you to do it here, and you have to follow the ownership process. Those are the two. Now, when it comes to consultation, the HP went to the DTI because they are looking at a program where they want to do equity equivalent investment program. And the DTI has actually given us their application to say we have to look at it and we have to advise. So that's part of the consultation. IBM has given us information because we asked how do they carry out their program. And then we've also had other telecom sectors that came to us in consultation to try and understand and engage us. When we did the two-day, the one-day consultation session just before the codes were gazetted for public comment, we had two sessions, a full session in the morning and a full session in the afternoon, where the industry was invited. Everybody who belongs to the ICT was invited. Some main companies had two representatives, one in the morning and one in the afternoon. And during that session, we actually kept records of the discussions. They were minuted, and the questions that were asked and the answers that we provided. So we had a very lengthy engagement with the industry, and that was before the gazetting for public comment. Now, you wanted to know why some of that was your question. Okay, I'll come to it. To finish yours, the composition of the council, if you go to the page where we've given names, it shows where they actually are coming from, page 7. And when you look at that, that's where actually the composition of the council comes from. Angela?
I just thought maybe I should just add that to take you through the first. And I'm just addressing the composition part. The council is divided into four subsectors. So we're going to start with the IT subsector, where you have Adrian Schofield, who comes from
the old professions, is the right? And then we also have Gavin, who comes from ITA. And then you've got the broadcasters, where you've got Pilari Gwangwa, who comes from NAB, the National Association of Broadcasters, which includes SABC, ETV. And then you've got myself under the electronics. I come from the Communications, Cabling, and the Electronics Industry Federation. So those are the industry subsets from a business point of view. Then we've got four social or including government subsectors. So we've got the chairperson, who's an advocate for women in ICT. We've got Councillor Moroesi, who represents youth. She sits on the Young Global Entrepreneurship Forum World. We have two representatives from government, which Councillor Petronella, who's also a disabled person. Invariably, as the minister indicated, we hijacked her to represent disability individuals. And then we've got one from the communications. We also have labor from Communications Workers Union, Councillor Richard and Councillor Tsepang. And then we've got one representative from social partners that was brought in from NEDLEC, who's Councillor Tulani. Thank you.
Thanks, DC. Through you, Chair. The last one was on remuneration. This is a point of contention for us as well, because when we were established, we were established with the idea that the department will fund 50% of our work, and the sector has to fund another 50% of our work. Now, we are being remunerated. At the moment, we don't get any funding from the sector except from the department, because we are coming up with a method with the DTI of having that funding realized, a mechanism where it will be set, because we don't want to be owed by anybody that is funding us. So at the moment, we feel like, Minister, you own us. But we do work against you at times, so we appreciate that you allow us to. So we actually want to make sure that we get our own funding so that we can be truly independent, and whatever money that comes to the council doesn't come from individuals to the council, but it comes as a contribution from the sector, where everybody is paying a certain percentage equally. So that will allow us to keep our independence, so that when we do advise and when we do engage, we don't feel indebted to anybody. And thank you for that question. Have I exhausted all your questions?
Yes.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Coming to the second question. Okay. ICT Code's views on consultation. The codes that we had of 2012, there were areas that were actually put in place for annual reviewing. That has not happened, because from 2012, we were supposed to have an ICT sector council, because it came from the ICT sector charter. However, we were only in existence in 2016. Or from 2015, end of the year 2016. Now, the years that went past from 2012 until we came into existence, no reviewing of whatever the 2012 codes were happened. Now, it is in that regard that when we were aligning the code, the DTI said we should treat that also as a review, because there are things that have to actually work towards transforming the sector. Now, when we engaged the sector, we shared the full document with the sector, and we got input, and on the 29th of October, we actually had a media statement where we highlighted the areas in the code that the council felt that we need to engage more, and we need to get clarity and understanding what happened. And in response, we got a lot of input against that submission. And we engaged with the DTI to say, this is how the council feels, and it was also general in the council to say, if we want to promote transformation, we shouldn't be putting caps in anything. We should allow companies to compete on an equal footing. So that is the consultation that took place that informed the final code. On the SMME developments, you're saying that 75% of companies, or the SMME has to be 75% in order for them to be leveled, to be, okay, all right. Okay, thank you. DC, would you like to take that?
The provision you're referring to for a qualifying small enterprise, you have to be 51%. So just as the first entry to the gate is that you must be less than 50 million. And then for you to be awarded a status of level one, you have to satisfy either two conditions. One, you must be 100% black owned, so that you get level one. And then to be level two, you either have to be 51% black owned or more than 51% black women owned. So the 75%, I think you're referring to, honorable member, it's more relating to the socio-economic development programs that must be implemented to rural. There's no turnover for the qualifications of those programs. And I just want to say on the questions around challenges, I want to just express that at the onset, the industry was very appreciative of the work that the council did. If you look at the timelines that the chairperson was indicating, if we did not align the sector code with the support from the ministry, our 2012 code was going to be repealed the same way as the construction sector code, well, that was repealed. And the implication of that was that it would literally be physically impossible for companies to implement the generic code. And what that would mean, it would have wiped out the entire investments that companies have put in since 2012. Those investments would have never been recognized, meaning that those companies would never be able to compete on basically the date when the minister would have repealed the code. So that was the first appreciation. The second aspect was that the input we received as a council, we realized that the input came from two different aspects. One was the input that suggests that we need to review the entire code, and the input that suggested that we needed to align. So as a council, we took a position to separate those two, and we focus on the alignment, but we are continuing engaging with the industry on the input where the industry is saying these provisions must be reviewed.
Thank you, DC. On the register, you said register of companies for inclusion. Okay. Colleagues, if you can remember, we came into existence only 18 months ago. If we were babies, we'd just be starting to run and starting to talk. However, we've managed to cover a lot of ground. There is still a lot of work to be done, we agree. And whilst looking at what we've covered, we are also looking forward to say what also needs to be done. And one of the areas is that one of having the SMMEs that can be used by those companies that say they are looking for them, they can't find them. And last year, end of last year, we actually tried to send out a request for proposals or request for information where we were calling on service providers to give us the area that they are working in, the constitution of the service provider, and also what expertise they have in order to create that repository. Now, this is still work in progress, so it hasn't been concluded. And also, on the skilled people, we will be working with the DBE, and I just want to say that on the capacity of the SA Women in ICT, we already are engaging with universities on IT-related studies, where last year we identified 20 girls that were given full scholarship by Belgium campus in Pretoria North to study IT. They wanted them to have done mathematics or maths literacy. And the girls that we found, some of them had 32% pass, others had 45% pass. Of the 20, one fell out immediately after registering, so she didn't carry on, and we couldn't bring a replacement. We were left with 19. The second one didn't write exams because she fell pregnant and couldn't return to the university. The 18 that wrote the examinations, 15 of them are going to second year. So this is proof that if you have a will for people to succeed and you put in place all the mechanisms for them to succeed, they will give it their best shot. So the university has asked us now this year to provide another list of 15 girls. So this is something that it was like a pilot. And if it works, it's something that now we will take to the industry to say, look, these are the mechanisms that we can use to start having, because five of the girls, the 15 girls, have got full scholarship from ArcelorMittal to complete their degree from second year until they finish. And there's only going to be 10 left that the company, the industry, will be fighting to absorb. So this is an opportunity that we see that if we have the will, we can actually assist instead of just demanding that things happen. So it's one of the mechanisms that we are going to be looking at. And also, with the partnership from the big stakeholders, we can have a full pool of this happening all over the universities in the country. I hope I've exhausted all your questions.
Okay.
The third question, identify practical challenges and adherence. The ownership, I've already alluded to that. What happens in the ownership space where companies want to use it as, I mean, not give us the true ownership and want to get the full points for ownership. And also why certain companies can't take on the employment, I mean the equity equivalent investment program, because already they've shown that they can give ownership to locals. I would say that when it comes to management control, we find that a lot of black people or affected sectors or affected people are in the middle and junior management. They don't go to senior management or even at executive level. What we actually discovering now is that the SOEs are actually pushing more black people into those executive levels, being CEOs, being executive, chief executive officers or chief financial officers, because they are pushing transformation. Now we need to have the private sector replicating that, and it's not happening. The excuses that we've received is that some companies that are multinational actually are dictated to by the global body. When they come to South Africa, they have to adhere to what the mother body structure dictates. Now, this is going to be a challenge, but maybe together we can find a solution on how we can make them actually adhere to the country where they are based, because they use South Africa as a springboard to the rest of Africa. So that also is another work in progress.
Just before I talk on, maybe let me start with practical challenges. Around SMMEs, there were basically two challenges. The one is that a lot of companies that claim to support SMMEs, actually they put money into funds, and then they claim points, but the funds don't disperse the money to SMME. And at the end of the day, it becomes a money-making scheme, because they basically create other businesses and create profits. And a lot of SMMEs, black-owned SMMEs, are saying, you know, we hear all these guys are saying, this is how much we've spent last year, but actually the money is sitting with some firm, an honorable member that has a trust that says, one day the money will be spent to black-owned SMMEs, and on that year, that company will claim and say we spend money. They'll come to this house, and then they'll project as if that's actually the money that's been seen. The other challenge that we're seeing is that where companies, and again, this is just from SMMEs, The code is silent on to the extent that one person can't benefit from everything. So what a lot of black-owned SMMEs are finding that once Andile comes in as a shareholder, he locks in everywhere. He wants to be the supplier. He wants to be the beneficiary every year. So it's silent on that. Just on the question, honorable member, of time, and I must say I appreciate that question because I'm reading Super Forecasting by Philip Tellock, and it says actually we come here and tell you things, but we never express time. When are these things going to happen? So in our context, I just want the House to note two timelines. So the way our code is structured, you almost have to look at it as a house. The foundation is the B Act, and in that house, you've got the generic act, which is your lounge and your kitchen where everybody has a common area. We occupy a specific room in the house of BEE. Now, on two dates that I would like you to note is that on the 24th of October 2014, the BEE Act effectively said the implementation of the act becomes effective. So in other words, before it was gazetted, I think in 2013, it gave in a grace period of 12 months, and that grace period ended on the 24th of October 2015. So that's the first timeline, which means all the things that we are referring to around the implementation of the Act became effective. The second date is the 7th of November 2015. This is 2016. This is the date that the minister signed the amended code into law. And thank Minister for supporting the provision that the code is effective immediately. So today we're sitting here, the code is effective immediately. So Honorable Chair, the concessions around skills development, around SMME development, around what the Chairperson was alluding to, are implementable effectively. And it's this Council that on an annual basis will come to this House and account to the extent that those provisions have been implemented in the economy.
Thank you, DC. Through you, Chair. The final question. Incentives of participating in the code. Okay. Companies, when they do business, intercompany business, they also want to be seen as citizens that are actually complying with transformation. The benefit is that they get the levels. And if you've noticed in advertisements or even when companies are giving us their history, the first thing they say is, we are a level whatever company, because that is the first benefit, to be seen to be compliant or to be seen to be promoting transformation. Now, for us, we said it's not compulsory, but if you want to do it properly. We are using it to say, much as you want to be level 5 or level 2, you need to ensure that you deserve that level. It shouldn't be something that is just window dressing. Hence, we're following through on what put you in that level. That's the first thing. And then the other one, the attraction between the council and the councils and the code. Okay. Do you want to speak to that?
Okay, thanks, Chair. Let me just also explain the context around the voluntary implementation of BEE. It's a silent government policy, the way BEE is structured. It's not expressed anywhere, but we explain it because often we get a hostile environment where people think if they don't do this thing, they go to jail. So a lot of the acts that this House passed, like employment equity, skills development, are punitive in nature. In other words, if you don't comply, you either get fined, or if you break the law, you go to jail. Whereas with BEE in its formation is that it encourages you to implement certain provisions so that you get benefits. And I can, so where we are today, in fact, I'm just also happy to report that the Treasury yesterday published the PPPF regulations, which uses plugs in into this process. Effectively, it means the reason for business to comply is now higher than the reason they don't. In simple terms, even though we don't say you shouldn't do it, but if you don't do it, there is no way that you can run a business in South Africa and be successful. So as a way, they make you become anti-competitive. So that's just closing that one. And then on the last one, you, Honorable Member, you asked, have we engaged with SMMEs on the code? Not in the context of targeted SMMEs. So if you look at the extent to which we had SMMEs on our stakeholder consultation was about 5%. What we are planning to do as of this month, we are engaging in the public awareness campaign of the code. And that one is targeted at the, in terms of numbers, how many people are going to be impacted by the code. And we are basically starting from the bottom to say communities are going to be impacted by the code. So we've got a program with the department to go across the entire 9 provinces to go engage communities, SMME, and we hope in our next report we'll report on that. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair.
Maybe on the SMME, I noted the issue of skills, which is quite critical, and well, all involved in ensuring that there's adequate skills. But I think as a department, we have consulted the SMEs before the council. There are a lot of small companies who are capable with all the qualifications and skills, but who are still not getting an opportunity to participate. We had a meeting with them, I think, in 2015. So, and one of their grievances was that particularly the big companies, they tend to try and absorb them or kill their ideas because of the competition in the sector. So I think once the BE Council is involved, I'm sure they'll find solutions to have meaningful participation of the small companies in our sector, because they are the ones who are generating more new ideas than the bigger companies. So we have got some programs to actually promote them, their participation in this sector. But I fully agree with you that we must continue to increase the skill space, because it's quite critical. As you have said, math and science are very critical. And that's why we're excited about this thing of ensuring that our children are given quality education, not this math literacy. Every child must have some basic mathematics thinking, because if we are thinking about this industrial revolution, there's a skill that it requires thinkers. You need people with capability to think. So I'm not saying that it's only math and science students who think, but I'm just saying that capability for analytic thinking and cognitive thinking and so on, it's very critical for the future skills the way we're going to. I thought that Chairperson, my sense is that much as these people came from the industry associations as representing the industry, I had a sense when we're launching them, because the industry was there, that they do have also a support of the industry and the community sector. It was one meeting where you get the community sector, unions, businesses, representative of big businesses agreeing on a common problem. I think it's a good idea. They need all our support. Thank you very much. And lastly, let me just, I forgot to congratulate the Effing Shepherd on her election. And I do wish you very well, and I know you'll do well. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. Yes, the last page, page 11, is just the outline of all the programs that will be carrying out 2017-2018.
Thank you very much. I think, follow-up question? Okay.
Thank you, Chair. I'm only a new MP, so I don't really understand exactly where your sector council fits into the bigger scheme of things. But if the if the department is paying for your activities, then there must be an element of oversight by this committee or by Parliament. And perhaps the minister could assist, how much of your department's budget was allocated towards this council? And, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, but Ms. Aaron said that you had paid for the activities, your department had paid for the activities of the council. So how much departmental budget has been allocated towards the council? And what's the, if you have it, Minister, the planned allocation for next year? And any data, I mean, I see you as a quango. I'm not sure if you're familiar with that term. I will read you the, I had to look it up myself, but it just sort of rang in my mind. It's a semi-public advisory and administrative body supported by the government and having most of its members appointed by the government. It's essentially a British, to do with British government. They closed down 192 of them in the quest for more efficient and lean government, just saying. You know, that kind of fits what your council is all about. In other state-owned entities or entities where the department funds them, and I think of Dot Zadner for an example, they come before this committee, they present a performance plan, we know what they're doing, we know how much they're getting paid, we know what their activities are and how much departmental budget is being put forward towards these activities. So I would just, if we're paying out of taxpayer funds for your entity, I would just like to see that kind of information before the committee. And then just to take it, my second question, just take it back to the ownership of listed companies. Clearly to have a rating, a BE rating is very, very important, not only for companies to be seen to be doing the right thing, because I don't think there's a person around this table that doesn't acknowledge that broad-based black economic empowerment is essential for an inclusive economy and essential for the future of our country. But the ownership of listed companies, to me, is absolutely critical, that question. How do you work out how much of a company that's listed on the stock exchange, like MTN or Vodacom or Telkom, is owned by black people in particular in our country? And then the concept of once empowered, you know, we had that in the mining sector where as far as I understand it, and that discussion could still be taking place. I try and confine myself to TTPS. But I have an IT company. I turn over 50 million rand a year. I sell my 30% to Honorable Tsotsi, or my 51% to Honorable Tsotsi, and she buys it through a transaction, and then she goes and sells it to Honorable Shin. And now I'm not empowered again. So how do you deal with that kind of thing in your council and in your deliberations? Thank you, Chair.
No, Chair, I did apologize. I hope later on that I've got another meeting at 3:30 in Pretoria. So I'm just sweating because of that. if the aircraft leaves me, then I'm in grave trouble. Our budget is very clear. As the chairperson has said, we are supposed to fund this thing together with the industry. Currently, the budget now is about 2 million. It's very ridiculous. But because the activity council is new, then we'll get the budget projection from the planned activities. Because in these 2 million, we have not really fully budgeted for the consultations and roadshows which they are planning. And we have not budgeted for the industry not coming soon into play. But for us, the work of the council is quite fundamentally important, because it is important to transform the sector. It is important to remove this huge spare capacity of people who are not participating in the economy, and yet they have got the capability to participate. So that's why we said we'll continue to fund, even on our own, We don't control them. Yes, I agree with you. If we are spending public funds and effort, the entities must come on account. And I think that it's in that context that we're coming to brief the committee on the plans and the initial work of the council. And I'm sure when they produce reports, because I don't sign off their reports, they sign off their reports. I think the committee will take them with great interest so that we can assist the industry. If you have had the trust offices to assist the industry to comply rather than just coming with the stick first. The last thing you have put, maybe the council will have their own view. Once empowered, always empowered, it doesn't work. That's artificial compliance. As far from where I see it, because if we check most of these empowerments still, it was people who were buying these things and being funded by the same companies or through banks. When they get into trouble, the company just buy, it's not just selling to Mrs. Chief. It's you buying back or your son buying back or your relatives or your other Zulus buying the same thing for your own benefit. So we're trying to say we don't want the, I think as a matter of principle, we don't want the things which are just happening just for the sake of it, and there's no real empowerment. And because when the state is disposed, yes, it's the owner of the state who is disposed, but I'm sure as a company you have a shareholders agreement which will determine. Any company will always have the choice how you'll dispose your stake. It's always in your shareholders' agreement. So that's why this shareholders' agreement must really be tightened then if the new buyers are going to be to prevent them from abusing the system. I think that's the only way we can deal with it effectively, from my point of view. But it's open for debate.
Thanks, Minister, I just want to answer two questions, the ownership of listed companies and the ones empowered. And I think just taking from where the Minister, but I just want to let you look at it in a different angle. The BEE is a lever that the state has to drive transformation. And the state has three things. One is licenses, issuing of licenses to the telcos in the ICT, procurement and concessions. So at the end of the day, in line with our constitution to ensure fairness and openness and transparency, you have to look at two entities. You've got entity A that does not have physical shareholders that you can meet that derive benefit. You've got entity B that has shareholders that are currently in inheriting risk and rewards. And as a state, you want to give them concessions. So the question would be, is it fair to treat them the same? The rules currently say no, because in our rules, in terms of the code, it says black people that must have voting rights, so which means we must find that black person and ask them, do you vote in the company? So in the case of once empowered, always empowered, that person would not be there. At the second aspect, it says, black people who derive economic interest. So we must find that person and say, are you currently deriving economic interest so that we can compare the two? So currently the rules don't allow a situation where if you exit a company, you can basically benefit from, or the company can benefit from your shareholding without having a BEE partner. Unless, of course, if you are constantly going to be paid dividends without you being there, then that's something else. The other aspect in terms of listed entities, this generic lounge that I was referring to of the DTI has certain rules currently in terms of how you treat listed entities. So our sector code adhere to those rules. But what we need to do is separate two things. There's a concept called direct empowerment and indirect empowerment. And there are rules in terms of how you measure indirect empowerment to a company. And there are also rules on how you measure direct empowerment to the company. Whereas that's why that whole controversy about the JSE empowerment was essentially about whether it's direct empowerment or whether it's not direct empowerment. But the contentious issue was about whether indirect empowerment can gain concessions from the state. That was it. Or can those indirect empowerment schemes gain concessions from the state? And right now that issue has not been resolved in terms of the court order or the amicable resolution.
Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I think we have exhausted our questions and comments. Let us thank the department for the renewal of the regulations and focus on what unites us as a country and also empower us in terms of the interaction with the world globally. And we know that South Africa was once isolated, and we are trying to do the operation catch-up. We don't want catch-up exactly with Europe, but we are trying our best and to make sure that we enhance the image of the country and, you know, for the good of our constituencies. We hope that moving forward from now, our counterparts will come back with a positive mandate. And we know all political parties in Parliament, you know, they have the same goal. We all want to see South Africa being a better country to live in. It's just that we differ in approach, but we think moving forward, we're going to have them on board and try to deal with the issues accordingly. As much as they differ with us sometimes, but we know that they mean well, they will come back with that positive response. And the cyber security is very crucial. You know, people's money, they just fly out of their bank accounts, and sometimes even our privacy is not protected. So we think that as we move forward, we are going to make sure that we deal with the challenge. And the pornography as well, it doesn't end up with us as telecommunications. We have communications, they have a Freedoms and Publication Board, and children are exposed to that. We also have the Department of Social Development, they also deal with the protection of children, and I think the Department of Education as well. Maybe in future, we'll try to have some joint committees with them to deal with the challenges. And on the SMMEs, you know, for a long time, we have been raising an issue about lack of progress and transformation in the SMMEC sector, the ICT sector. So we think that we have a special focus, and there will be a lot of progress. And we know that one of the major recipients of the benefit of the VCC sector code is the development and sustainability of the small businesses within that particular sector. And South Africa needs entrepreneurial expertise. You know, sometimes small businesses, they collapse because people do not have the required skills. Sometimes we just enter into businesses to address issues of unemployment, whereas we don't have necessary skills. So through you, we think that we are getting there. And this council play a major primary role to ensure that small businesses will be developed. You know, we talk about the small businesses like we want to see them sitting there smaller and smaller and smaller, getting smaller. We want to say small today, and as we move forward, they get bigger and bigger until they are able to compete with some big business. We always have to start somewhere before we get there. And having that, we thank you all for the presentation. And to the committee, we have this committee program that we have some alteration here or adjustment on the... That is the 14th of February. Oh, yeah, sorry. Officials can leave the 1-2. Okay. So we have noted the change in the program about the 14th of February. In the past, we've been postponing because of the challenges that we have. But now we think we're going to be on it and get done with it. Thank you very much. Member Shin, we're waiting for you to come back with that mandate. Yeah, I said we're looking forward to the positive mandate when you come back from your party. We know that you mean well. Like I say, we are all in one. We only differ in terms of the approach, but the goal is the same. Thank you very much.
Chairperson, if you would fly us to these events, then we could see for ourselves and vote on you.
Thank you.